So, Courtney, where are you? Are you in Grand Forks?
I'm in St. Cloud.
Your son goes to St. Cloud?
Yes.
What's the school?
St. Cloud State University.
Okay. Oh, I love St. Cloud. We used to go there for the Granite City Classic competition, skating competition every year. Oh my gosh, it's a great community.
Oh, that's really good to hear.
So he's going to be a freshman.
That's right.
What's his major?
Computer science.
Of course, Mr.
Yes.
Rubik's Cube. That's just fascinating. Oh, I can't wait to see what he becomes. That's so cool.
Nice to say. He's on the swim team.
Oh, he is. That's great. I was going to ask you why, out of all the schools, how do you get to your decision? But that narrows it down, I suppose, huh?
Yeah, close it down.
So, is this his dorm room or where are you?
I'm at the hotel.
Oh, okay. All
Right.
right. I was going to say that looks really nice. What? Oh, very nice.
All right. Well, I thank you everyone for putting up with me visiting about my son and Joan's enthusiasm. So thank you. I think we'll get started. Good evening, everyone. This is the North Dakota Medical Association's Wednesday webinar, an open forum discussion. I'm Courtney Koble, Executive Director of NDMA, and I would also, on behalf of NDMA, welcome everybody and thank you for your membership. And I also want to welcome our public health guests, and we invited public health officials from our COVID-19 advocacy physician and public health group that we just started hosting. It was originally with the Department of Health, and then now NDMA is hosting this. And we're very happy that everybody could join us. Thank you. And just a reminder to everyone that this webinar is being recorded. One of my pre-COVID announcements, I wanted to extend to all NDMA members on this call. President Misty Anderson is anxious to meet everybody and visit all the districts. And so she, if you're planning on having a meeting in person, which probably is not the case, she'd be more than happy to come to that. But we'd also like to offer our Zoom platform for any district meetings. And Misty could visit about the annual meeting, any legislative issues, and just get to know people at least through Zoom. So that I want to put that out there. Also in COVID news today or public health news, Andrew Stahl submitted his resignation and Governor Burgum accepted it. And his last day is August 31st. And we all know that he's been doing a awesome job, and so we'll miss him, but we wish him well, and we're very happy that he's staying here in the state. I talked about our meeting, the public health meeting that originally, or the public health physician advocacy meeting that originated with the Department of Health. Joan Connell's going to continue to host that and does meeting minutes that we publish in our e-physician, and gives updates on these webinars as well. Our next webinar is going to be September 2nd, and I'm pleased to announce that Dr. Mateo from Sanford Bismarck is going to be our speaker on September 2nd. So the other issues that the group works on are issues like testing, treatments, nursing home issues, and as of late, school reopening. And relating to that, last week, NDMA Council sent a letter to all the school boards in the state asking, strongly recommending that they follow CDC guidelines and requiring face coverings for educators, staff, and students when in schools. So at all times. I think some of our schools are if it's 6 feet or apart or more, but I'm not sure if that's doable in schools. The NDMA also advised that schools should follow CDC guidelines for keeping youth athletes safe. And I think also today, the state released that dashboard for the counties. And NDMA had done some advocacy work on in this behind the scenes on that, and so we're very happy to see that that has been released, which will be very helpful for public health and for the schools and all the people in the counties. Tonight's webinar panelists, of course, we've got our own Joan Connell. She's the field medical officer for the North Dakota Department of Health, and she also leads our physician advocacy group, and she'll share the latest COVID-19 update. And then our guest presenter is Dr. Carl Vidal. Dr. Vidal is originally from Canada, and he originally practiced as a chiropractor in Arizona for several years prior to returning to medical school. Following graduation, he did his residency with the Bismarck-Hettinger Rural Family Medicine Program, and he graduated in 2019. He returned to Arizona to join an independent family medicine practice, and he is in excellent health. But last spring, he contracted COVID, resulting in extensive hospitalization. He's going to share his experience tonight as a coronavirus patient and also as a physician whose practice has been dramatically changed by the pandemic. As usual, after the presentations, we'll have the opportunity for open discussion and questions. If you have a question, please type your question in the question box or raise your hand. And if necessary, you'll be unmuted to present your question or discussion topic. So I will hand it over to Joan. And thanks again, everyone, for being here. Thanks.
Courtney, thank you so much for having me. And thank you for participating on this big day that you're having with your son and your family. I'm going to keep my statement pretty short because all of the things that Courtney was talking about are all of the things that I've been working on. So I'm going to try not to be redundant here. I will try and augment, if necessary, some of the points. So regarding the COVID physician group that was once belonging to North Dakota Department of Health, but then once Dr. Stahl was licensed, you know, technically the Department of Health did not need an advisory group of physicians because they had a physician as a state health officer. So we continued to meet. Thank you to North Dakota Medical Association to share what was going on in our communities and to problem solve some of the things that we were serving as stakeholders, like the school group, like the Burley Morton Task Force, like local public health leaders, and those sorts of things. For a couple of weeks, we have changed our name from advisory to advocacy. But this has, we have to change that back because if we use the name advocacy, we cannot invite our state health stakeholders and partners to our meetings. So we're going to continue to be the COVID physician advisory group and be able to provide advice to anyone who seeks it, including people within the group. The other big thing, can you guys all hear me? Because Courtney's frozen. Can you wave or? Okay, thanks. The other big thing I guess I'll spend a little bit more time on, two things. The dashboard that now has county-specific information as well as state information, and that is a big improvement, especially as a lot of our state policy relegates decision-making to local control via local public health and school boards or local public health, period. So it's really important that they have this data. The dashboard was rolled out this morning. There are a few tweaks that I'm recommending, and I know on the Burley Morton subcommittee that I serve, education and kids and recreation, they're concerns were similar to mine. So there is a place right at the top where you can leave your feedback. So please look at the dashboard. And if there are things that you would like tweaked on it, provide that feedback because they're interested in making it available for the citizens to use the data to help make decisions about how to manage during the pandemic. That brings me to the school openings. There was an incredible amount of work done in the last couple of weeks to try and write down processes, procedures, come up with an agreement of how to how to manage to prevent cases and when there are cases in the K through 12 schools. And quite a number of resources have become available through this. There was a glitch this morning in determining the best approach to make sure personal health information was protected and was definitely going only to those people who absolutely required it in a way that would keep PHI safe while protecting the public health. And this was a big discussion that involved Kirsten Baszler, Dr. Stahl, I think Attorney General Stengem, the governor, you know, a lot of big leaders in our state to make sure that they got it right. As you can imagine, the lawsuits that would come from not getting this right would further devastate our state. So I think that there were some decisions made by the end of the day. I didn't hear Kirsten Baszler's portion of the press conference. So maybe somebody can fill me in on that, but it sounds like it got fixed. So if she didn't reveal that, I think the plan and that all of those resources will be rolled out within the next day or two. Finally, you know, just a word about Dr. Stahl's departure. You know, I think I hope you all can appreciate the tremendous load he has carried and the amazing job he's done as our lead physician to lead us in this time. And I hope that that there's a lot of support. With that, I would like to recognize all of my colleagues in the health department. I don't know how many of you have had this much turnover in your leadership during a pandemic, but it's a this is hard, and your health department needs your leadership, your support, and needs you to put out a good word for them to the community who is upset and really critical about many things right now as this pandemic wears on. So I ask that you give my colleagues in the health department and Dr. Stahl and whoever replaces Dr. Stahl is our third state health officer in 6 months. Lots of support and encouragement. Thank you. And Dr. Vidal, I can't wait to hear your presentation, and I think I might start crying during it, so I might have to turn my camera off.
Thanks a lot, Joan. Yes, again, thank you, Dr. Vidal, and I see he's in Hettinger right now. I'll just hand it over to you for you to tell us what you know. Thanks.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Well, obviously, I've had months to process everything that's happened to me. Just reflecting back, you know, gives me an opportunity to, you know, tell especially healthcare professionals about my experiences, especially, you know, in the ICU and, you know, being in a medically induced coma. I guess going back, just talking about a quick synopsis of the journey that I had, it started off in March, toward the beginning of March. I went on a trip with a couple other residents and, I ended up going through San Francisco and Miami, and we headed down to Columbia. This is before lockdown restrictions. You know, people have asked me, do you think you contracted this in the clinic? You know, in the clinic, obviously, you know, even back then, you know, we're, you know, you're donning a mask and washing your hands before going in and coming out of, you know, every room, and we weren't allowing patients that were actually patients that had fevers. We weren't accepting them at that time because we didn't have appropriate testing. So, you know, I really think I kept myself safe in the clinic. The place that I think I obviously contracted the virus was on the plane. Nobody was wearing masks. The plane was at capacity. So I think really what it was is I was exposed to a large viral load over a long period of time. So, you know, when I got back from Colombia, you know, I started to experience some GERD-like symptoms that I've never experienced before. Just to know, you know, I've always been healthy, don't have any other comorbidities, and I've never really been sick before. So the GERD resolved, the reflux resolved, and I remember working through the week, and on Friday, I started to develop a cough, and cough kind of progressed on the Saturday with some shortness of breath. We're looking at about a 10-day time frame from when I got back from the trip. So Saturday, the shortness of breath got worse. I was coughing up some blood. And then when I looked at my oxygen saturations, I was in the 80s, and my wife looked at me and she goes, "You're going in now." And so went into the emergency room. They made me the ICU. Initially started off on like 4 liters, and that brought my saturations up. And literally it progressed so rapidly. I had one night in the ICU the next day. It was up to 15 liters, and I was barely maintaining saturations. And, the intensivist was like, we should intubate you. I'm like, just let me see if I can get through this. Anyways, I in the morning I was exhausted, and I asked them to intubate me. They did. Took like 800 milligrams of propofol to put me up. It's probably because I was just the anxiety and the adrenaline of going through that. And then I woke up, in the ICU, elated that I was in reality again. I was paralyzed. I couldn't talk because I had the trach in, which you think would be a pretty traumatic experience for most people. Luckily, going through medicine, you have the opportunity to spend time in an ICU. I've intubated patients with Dr. Ranum. We've hooked them up onto ventilators. So that environment isn't scary to us. And what was scary actually, and this is something I wanted to share with everybody that's in the healthcare profession, was, the medically induced coma. Obviously, with the way things are now, it's not like pre-COVID when family members could go into the ICU and visit their family members and hold their hands and talk to them. That doesn't happen. You're by yourself. And I was talking to Dr. Randall about it, and I kind of explain it like a dream state. We sleep anywhere from 6 to 10 hours a night, and we dream. And I think if you have a bad dream, we wake up from that. If the dream progresses, eventually we wake up from that, we go about our day. So what happened is, initially I was just on Nimbex, and I was going through this dream state, and it was cycling from one dream to the next dream to the next dream. And in my subconscious and in my dream state, I knew that this wasn't right and I needed to get out. And I was trying to find a way to get out. And I did actually manage to pull out my ET tube. And that's what led to my pneumonia. And after that, they put me on ketamine. They added ketamine to the Nimbex. And that's kind of when it took a turn for the worst. And I was in this room, kind of suspended above this room looking down. And I remember there's a clock in front of me. And there would be somebody that would come out once in a while and walk around this room. And I'd hear this echoey voice. And sometimes he would be talking to somebody in the front of the room that I couldn't see. And the problem with this is, it went on hour after hour, day after day after day after day. So then I woke up, and I woke up out of this state of purgatory, not being able to move, not being able to speak, and happier than I've ever been in my entire life, to get out of that. I guess the point I'm trying to make is when somebody's unconscious, they're in a medically induced coma, they can hear you. I compartmentalize this scenario. The echoey voice is somebody wearing a N99 with a respirator. You know, that person walking around that room was probably a nurse or a doctor talking to somebody outside the room. So, unfortunately, and maybe it's ketamine, which I'm allergic to now, by the way. You know, I think that was a scenario I kind of lived in. Unfortunately, you know, I think if family members could have come and visited me, held my hand, talked to me, it would have made that situation, that alternate reality that I was in, much more bearable. So the message to get from this is your patients, if they're in a coma, grab their hand, talk to them. Tell them everything's going to be okay. And then just as far as, you know, what I went through in the course of all of this was, I had tension pneumothorax. I had two pneumothoraxes. I had a bilateral hemothorax. You know, they did so many bronchoscopies on me. Dr. Suya, who is my critical care team, he went in with his full PPE and spent like 7 hours in bronchoscopy using a cryo tip to freeze and pull out all the clots out of my lung. My entire respiratory tree on both sides was full of blood. I had DIC. The funny thing is, with all of this being said, I had 3 negative respiratory swabs. It came back. They were actually starting to think that it might not be COVID. They thought maybe I had picked up some type of hemorrhagic fever from, you know, from South America. They were actually going to put me on the floor and, you know, infectious disease called my wife and told them that my bronchoscopy specimen finally came back positive. Then obviously we knew, you know, I had COVID, and they kept me on that floor. So I basically was in a medically induced coma for 24 days, on a ventilator for 37, in the hospital for 55. What else? If you want to open it up to any questions, I'd be more than happy to answer questions.
Sure thing. Thanks a lot, Dr. Vidal. Very powerful story. One question I have before we get started on everybody else's, did you mention that you were on that ECMO machine?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. It's nice to get you questions. So the ECMO, so essentially I started off in, I was with Dignity Health at one of their satellite hospitals. I was on the ventilator there for a week and I was failing the ventilator. At 24 hours to live, essentially, and they came and they hooked me up to the ECMO. I was transferred to St. Joe's. That's where they have the Norton Thoracic Surgical Institute for lung transplants. And luckily, they weren't doing elective cases at that time, so they had the resources to put me on the ECMO and watch me there. So I was failing ECMO for 10 days. And they were contemplating whether or not, you know, I was going to live at that point. And miraculously, I kind of turned the corner and finally got off ECMO, went through all of those complications, and turned out on the other side. So
well, that's terrific. Now, these ECMO machines, is that widely used now for other people with COVID or not?
I mean, it's complicated. I've talked to the critical care doc quite a few times. You know, they have a criteria that the patient has to meet in order to qualify for that. He was telling me the other day there was a 25-year-old on the unit that he had a cardiac output of was like 25. And then there was a 50-year-old that was a better candidate. So unfortunately, the 25-year-old passed away. And, you know, when I was on the floor there, there was 20 people in the COVID unit. They opened up more units. And now the last time, well, I don't know what it is now, but about 3 weeks ago, he said there's about 120 on the unit. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, yeah, that's the other thing too. Well, I'll let you guys ask some questions and then I have some couple things I wouldn't mind saying towards the end.
Oh, sure. Well, Dr. Chatelain had a question. He says there are a number of articles available online about the possible relationship with MMR and other vaccines in reducing the severity of COVID-19. A particular interest might be the incidence of vaccination in school openings. Along the same line of thought, the seasonal flu vaccine should be available soon. So maybe that's more of a comment, but I don't know if you wanted to talk more about vaccines.
Yeah, that was interesting with the MMR, you know, correlation to COVID. And that study, they actually, they called me to do that study, but I couldn't, at that point, I couldn't talk or obviously text. It was just after I got out of the ICU, so I wasn't able to really participate in that. You know, as far as vaccines, you know, the funny thing is, through all of this, I haven't had a chance to talk to a lot of medical professionals, and, you know, I have done some reading, so, you know, my knowledge is, you know, somewhat limited, and obviously, we know this is just, we're learning every day, so we can't take a hard stance on anything at this point. You know, this is what we think today, and, you know, and it can change it, you know, from one day to the next almost, right? So, you know, I look at, you know, influenza, you know, I know the vaccination that came out for that was in 2009, you know, and we're, even though that virus has mutated so many times, that same, you know, vaccination that adds those core proteins that the body is able to mount an immune response, it does, even to those mutated strains. And I think, you know, some of these asymptomatic carriers out there, you know, did they have, you know, coronavirus, you know, multiple times in the past, and that they have some of those core protein that, you know, they can recognize on maybe, you know, COVID-19, and that's one reason why they don't get as sick or they stay asymptomatic. It's a good question. I've been looking for reasons why somebody as healthy as me got as sick as I did. You know, you look at the ACE2 receptors, you know, as we get older, they become more predominant, and they're more predominant in males versus females. But I still wonder why I got as sick as I did. So you start looking for genetic components. I mean, that's up in the air. As far as I really think it comes down to viral load exposure too, to somebody who's maybe naive to, you know, this virus. And like I said, it was kind of a perfect storm, and I was in the wrong place at the right time. And well, the rest is history as far as that. And, you know, I will never really know. I had my titers recently drawn before I came to North Dakota, and, you know, you hear a lot about people talking about getting reinfected, and, hey, I had positive antibody tests, and, you know, I caught it, and I'm sick again. And, you know, I think it's with anything, you know, just like varicella, for example. You know, if you don't have a high enough titer, your body doesn't conform immunity to it. I'd like to think the same thing with COVID. You know, you do a finger stick, and it says you're positive or you're not, but there's no titer saying what level your antibodies are at. So yeah, you know, maybe you get sick again, but you don't get as sick. The titers that I had, my titers were 6.5, which is 1 to 320. That's where I was the last time. That's kind of from what I've read, that's a baseline for you to donate convalescent plasma. And I believe, and I asked one of the docs what my initial titer was. And he said he was looking back in the charts, and he was having a hard time finding it, but my chart probably looks like that. But I remember my wife saying something about 200. And if it's 20, which is 1 to 1,000, it's come down. We're going to trend my antibodies every 3 months and see, you know, how long will I have immunity for? Do I think I have immunity to this? Well, if I can donate my plasma, to give others, for other people to actually fight off this virus, then I'd like to think that I'm immune to it at this point. So.
Now you got it so early, I suppose you didn't get convalescent plasma.
No, they weren't even doing convalescent plasma at Dignity Health at that time, actually, because of me, and they were trying to get it for me. They started the program, so the program's in place now.
Well, that's good.
You know, they tried to get remdesivir for me too, to stop viral replication. They couldn't get that either. And then when I was in the cytokine storm, they finally got tocilizumab, and I received that to help with the cytokine storm. But the other medications, it was hard, and a lot of that was being deferred to New York, I guess, at the time. Hence the reason why they're a hard time getting it. But that's another thing, you think of, and I asked the infectious disease doc, before I got released, and he just said, we don't know right now, but, could you have such a hardy immune system that, by the time your body recognizes and attacks it, it sends you into, that cytokine storm, which caused me to go in full-blown ARDS, and then the rest was just kind of.
Did anyone from your group that you were traveling with get COVID?
No, nobody did. So I traveled there by myself. And then I met them there. I came home, and my dad's 80 years old. He's a very healthy 80-year-old. But nevertheless, I was with him for an entire week in close proximity. And he went back to Canada, and he never contracted the virus. Thank goodness. My children were unaffected. I prescribed myself hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, and I took that. The jury's out on that one. It didn't do anything for me. What else was I going to say? I was using nebulizers, budesonide and albuterol to help me breathe. So unfortunately, I was aerosolizing the virus, and my wife did get sick. She was sick for about 13 days, but, she obviously, thank goodness she didn't end up in the hospital. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
We have a question from Dr. Mark Carter. Do you have any long-term residual symptoms, or other problems from the infection?
Yeah, I was just talking to Dr. Random when I was looking up at the screen. My eyesight is what it used to be, but that's probably from the anoxia I suffered when I was, being transferred from ECMO. Other than that, I'm truly, absolutely blessed. You think about the multi-organ system damage that this causes. My liver, heart, kidneys are fine. Everything's recovered. My PFTs are borderline normal. And honestly, I really believe that it was 117 when I left Arizona. So if you go out for a run, it's got to be about 4 o'clock in the morning. So I haven't been, that cardiovascular reserve is still coming back. I got up here, actually ran around the lake, which was something else. I have some blebs, small blebs in my left lung. Some peripheral scar tissue, 95% of my lungs on CT were clear. So.
Oh, that's terrific. All right. I'm going to open it up. I think I've got all the questions answered. Like I talked about in the beginning, I am not in the office. I am off site. So I'm going to open it up to any of the participants. If you want to raise your hand. And it looks like Joan Connell raised her hand.
Call it Joan first. I think she's pretty eager.
Dr. Vidal, thank you so much for sharing your brave story. And
nice to see you.
It's great to see you, and I'm so excited. That's such a great physician and a great dad and a great husband. your job is not done, clearly. So I wanted to clarify, no dexamethasone for you. And then I also wanted to ask how long it took. So you said 54 days in the hospital. So when did you start back at work? And do you feel, I heard you say you ran around the lake, but do you feel like you can get through the day pretty normally yet?
Well, I think I'm proving that right now. Yeah. Been on call for the last 48 hours. Yeah, dexamethasone, it wasn't even part of the protocol back then. I think when they got me on, when I was having the cytokine storm, they were doing methylprednisolone 125, and then along with the tocilizumab. You know, when I got into rehab, I could barely walk. I was using a cardiac walker. I could maybe walk 10 feet. I'd desat and have to sit down. And I honestly didn't think I'd ever be able to do anything significant again in my life. It's a very humbling feeling how quick your body can just, you know, decondition. But the fortunate thing is it reconditions. And for the first couple months, I lost 50 pounds. I put it back on, not the kind of weight I wanted to put back on, but I put it back on. And, forever I was having issues eating in the beginning. But that can be explained by a lot of different things, and just started a probiotic and digestive enzyme, and it made significant changes, Pepcid as well. And I was dizzy, but my blood pressure was so low. As soon as I started putting on some weight, I wasn't having those orthostatics anymore. And then slowly but surely my conditioning kind of came back, and I did go up to California and I hiked up to 9,000 feet. We did about 5 mile round trip hike, and it was hard, really hard, but I don't want to let something like this beat me. I'm stubborn, and I'll keep pushing until I get back to who I was. And I had the opportunity to come up here at West River. They were talking about the practice in the beginning. If you look at the numbers, when I got discharged on the 15th of May, they lifted the restrictions and bars opened and restaurants and so on and so forth. And we drove through, and there was a bar in Gilbert that we drove by, and there's like 70 people in lineup and a foot apart and not wearing masks. And I looked at Elisa and I'm just like, this is bad. And about 4 or 5 weeks later, incidence rates climbed to 3,500. And then in June, they implemented mandatory mask wearing. And lo and behold, I was looking the other day, the incidence rates are down to 600 to 1,000 now. So for those of
how did you know what my next question was going to be? I wanted to ask you, with your experience, what is the best thing that NDMA can do to advocate for the citizens of our state?
I mean, what the CDC has been saying all along, just we need to wear masks and you need to wash your hands. You look at the respiratory droplets, the larger droplets will fall and land on surfaces. So that's contact. The smaller ones aerosolize, and they're in the air. The larger droplets obviously are going to have a larger viral load in them as opposed to the aerosolized virus. However, you think about it and you hear about people talking about masks and, the virus can get through a mask. Well, micron size of a virus, yeah, it's going to pass through a mask. And so it's an oxygen molecule, right? But I had a neighbor the other day whose son thinks it's a conspiracy and the masks don't work. So I gave him that analogy of the size of an oxygen molecule in the virus and had him blow out a candle from 6 feet, had him put a mask on, and he couldn't blow it out at half a foot. I mean, there it is. Right? There it is. So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Joan. Misty Anderson, she had a question, and she also had her hand up, so she might want to talk about it with you. But she asked, what is your blood type? And actually, I'm interested in that, too, because I was going to ask that.
You guys want me to start donating? you want to keep a bag of my plasma in your fridge? It's AB negative.
Okay. I think that's related to, at one point, they were saying that certain blood types have a worse reaction to COVID, and that's why she's asking that.
You were occupied during that time, Carl. So that was 2 weeks where that blood type was high.
Yeah.
I missed that.
I missed a lot. I wish I would have missed the Arizona summer, but
yeah. Misty, did you have any follow up on that?
Well, no. My other questions I had were already answered by other questions. That was an excellent presentation, and I just keep hearing about the blood type because my husband is O, so that's why. That's why I thought to ask you that question, because I guess O has been said to be the best type to have.
Well, that's good. And then Dr. Casimir from Minot, you had a question.
You mean it's a comment and a question. You know, you obviously received an excellent care. And it seems everything was done to save your life, which is good. We don't have ECMO facilities here. And when this, when the pandemic started, I thought that was one of the things we should explore. What do you think? I don't know how many hospitals in North Dakota have ECMO capabilities. And my fear is that, we may be, allowing some patients that we could save their lives or come to this disease without ability to avail them of ECMO. Do you think it's something that, the hospitals, either with the assistance of some states or with funding from state or federal government, should explore getting to their institutions? What's your opinion about ECMO for patients that have COVID-19?
Well, I'm talking to you right now, right? Yeah. So you know what my opinion is. It saved my life. Like I said, I had a 100% chance of mortality before they put me on ECMO. It allowed my lungs to heal to the point that it gave me a chance to stay alive. Looking at all of their faces and, when they recently saw me, seeing the condition I'm in now, I know they were all happy that they made that decision. And like I said, they've been using the ECMO on patients ever since. And sorry, I don't have the criteria for what patient, is a candidate for ECMO or not. But I guess because I was young, I was healthy, I was still strong. My cardiac function was normal. Cardiac output was good. I qualified, and thank goodness that I did. We're going to do a charity hike with the Doctors That Saved My Life, and that's to get funding for ECMOs in the satellite hospitals to St. Joe's. So instead of them having to bring their ECMO machine to that satellite hospital, they'll have it and be able to hook patients up and then transfer them out to the ECMO floor. So,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Casimir, for that question. Dr. Carter, Mark Carter, you had your hand raised. Did you have a question?
Can you hear me now?
I can.
Yeah, so, now we can.
Yeah, I'm just as a follow-up to the question.
We lost you, Dr. Carter.
Managed to mute again by itself. Can you hear me now again?
We can
hear you now.
Yeah, I was just following up to the question that I asked you before, and you said you were having some visual trouble. I'm curious as to if you had a follow-up CT or anything like that, because I'm a retired has-been. All I have time is to read about the thing. But anyway, I've noticed that as people who've had CTs, seems to be a predilection for the occipital lobes and the posterior fossa as to where there's neurological changes and damage. And I just wondered if you'd had any follow-up appertaining to that, since you've said your sight's not as good as it was.
No, the only follow-up I've had at this time is at a CT of the chest, the pulmonary function tests, and that's it. And just having my titers redrawn. So that might be something we want to investigate further, definitely. I still haven't gone over all of, I haven't received the notes from the hospital after having gone over my own hospital stay at this point. So
thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Dr. Carter. Debbie Swanson asks you, Dr. Vidal, would you consider telling your story to a newspaper reporter in North Dakota to help us spread the word about the serious nature of COVID?
You know, absolutely. I can't tell you one thing that was, you know, I was talking to Dr. Schaefer-McLean about it the other day when I was up in Bismarck and how nobody there is wearing masks, you know, and it's kind of disheartening, but, and it was the same scenario in Arizona until they mandated mask wearing, even though a lot of people, as I'm not wearing a mask right here, but you see a lot of people wearing the masks down, you know, below their nose. So if we can spread awareness just, you know, and touch a small group of people, it would be worth it. So yeah, the answer to that is yes.
Well, that's really good to hear. We can put you in touch with somebody. I know there's a health reporter that I talk with a lot at the Fargo Forum, but I will get in touch with you and Dr. Ranum after this, and I think you'd be a great story. So thanks.
Okay. Can I just insert here that the North Dakota Department of Health is looking for those stories too, but I wasn't going to ask you. I was just going to share your name. Sorry. And Carl, I wanted to share with you, thank you so much for the very personal story of your coma. I had this patient when I was in residency at Denver General. He was a skateboarder who was involved in a motor vehicle accident. And he was in ICU. For some reason, I got to spend the whole winter of my senior year at Denver General. And so every fourth night, I was the supervisor of the ICU and would go and check on the patients. And I would go into his room and I would talk to him. And I actually did hold his hand. He was this adorable kid and he always had reggae music playing in his room. And my time came and went. And actually, I must have been an intern because the next year was Columbine, and I was at Children's Hospital, which was affiliated with Denver General, right after Columbine happened. And I heard this kid yell, "Dr. Connell, Dr. Connell!" And I looked, and it was this boy, and he had recovered from his coma, and he knew my name. And there was only one way he would have known that, because he was in a coma the entire time I was there. So I think we can't share the reality of that and how important we are. And in every moment of every day, physicians are being watched and needed to be our best selves. So thank you for reminding us of that.
Yeah, thank you. And actually, that being said, yeah, you know, I say if you don't have anything good to say, don't say it at all. As far as being in one of those rooms that a patient is in a coma, being in a surgery. But what you said, this boy said to you, my father-in-law, when I finally was able to FaceTime and able to speak, I said, oh, I remember, you know, when I came to, and it was kind of hazy, but you said to me, you go, hey, you're a fighter, prove it, get out of that bed. And he goes, you're in a coma, when I said that to you. So there you go.
Wow. We have a comment here. Julie Ferry extends her thanks so much for sharing your story. And thanks for reminding all of us, whether physicians or nurses, of the power of touch and the ability to hear in the hospital. Greatly appreciated.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
All right. As I indicated, I'm a little hampered technology-wise here. I'm on my phone, but if anybody has questions, type them in or raise your hand, and I'm going over the attendee list. If anyone has any questions. Well, any final comments then, Dr. Vidal?
I'm happy to be alive.
Oh yeah, definitely. Very powerful story. I offer NDMA up for any resources. We've got our vice president sitting next to you right there. And we appreciate you coming and spending the time with us and telling your story. I'd like to remind everybody that our next webinar is going to be September 2nd, and we're going to have Dr. Mateo, who is an infectious disease doctor at Sanford Bismarck. And we've been doing these every couple weeks now. Our e-physician tomorrow will have some more information about our annual meeting, which we're going to be doing over a couple of weeks. With the congressional forum and policy forum. And we're going to have, hopefully, our two senators and representatives be guests. And then we are going to have time to have a discussion virtually, of course, about policy. I'm going to open it up one more time for any questions. Dr. Govan, any idea what your BOSP bill was?
Right. You know,
building, maybe.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
You know, I remember when the day they released me from the hospital, you know, I had a hard time walking, let alone standing there for that long. And that was one of the reporters asked a question she asked me. I mean, you can probably imagine how much it cost. I know my insurance company just paid one of many bills, which was over 180,000, and to be honest with you, I haven't got all the bills yet, and I don't know what the entire cost is at this point. I do know that hopefully what my insurance company doesn't cover under the CARES Act, I know money's been allocated to hospital chains, and hopefully that will cover the remaining expenses, so we'll find out.
Well, that's good to hear. Very good. All right. I think, Joan, do you have any final comments?
No, just Dr. Vidal, thank you again so very much for sharing your story and participants in this webinar. You know, we need to be boots on the ground. We need to respond to the community that's looking to us for answers. And for guidance on how to respond to what's going on right now. So let's be strong, let's be boots on the ground, and let's honor the sacrifice of all of the care providers for Dr. Vidal and for Dr. Vidal for paying it back now and sharing this time with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you in a couple weeks. And thanks again, Dr. Vidal.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. How do we